Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios in downtown Milwaukee, it's Wisconsin's Midday News, making stories come to life. Now, here are your hosts, Greg Matzik, and in for Jessica Tai, it's Neil Doyle.
Looks like joint practices are wrapping up in Green Bay. No fights. Yeah, no fights. And that seems like a common thing when you get two teams, right? You want to hit somebody else, great, and some kind of fight breaks out and everybody gets mad. It doesn't appear to have happened today in Green Bay.
I kept checking Twitter. It seemed pretty cordial between the two sides.
I think that was part of the discussion going into this. And, of course, you got brothers as the head coaches of each team. And, well, they're going to have dinner tonight, so you want to make sure you're having a pleasant conversation around the dinner table at the LaFleur household. Packers and Cardinals wrapping up joint practice today, and we'll wrap up the preseason Friday night at Lambeau.
Here's your top two at two on Wisconsin's Midday News.
Deadly flash flooding and mudslides in Nepal, killing scores of people and leaving hundreds of others missing, including three Americans. Now, the death toll is on its way up, according to officials. More from ABC's Lama Hassan at the foreign desk.
Where this took place near the border with China is a popular destination with tourists. And according to the Nepalese Tourism Board, nearly 400 tourists are missing. The army has urged people to remain on high alert and to stay in safe places.
It's another one of those stories where I can tell you this is deadly and how devastating it is. And then you watch the video and just see it. Right? I mean, these are the mountains of Nepal near the border of China. And in the valley of these mountains are buildings, schools, structures, and a river that runs sort of through the community. Those neighborhoods are gone. It started as an avalanche and it reached the water and then it turned into flooding because of the avalanche. Like, just an absolute catastrophic situation playing out in a very popular tourist area of Nepal.
Yeah, the images and videos, very disturbing. It's crazy to see.
Just completely wiped out these buildings. My goodness. So there is fear that the death toll is going to rise. The amount missing is only going to rise. Already, the Nepalese Tourism Board says nearly 400 tourists are missing. Three American tourists have died, according to reports from overseas. And this is sort of just the beginning, unfortunately. Repairing that community will be incredibly difficult and take quite a bit of time, but a horrific natural disaster in Nepal.
The sudden closure of a Wisconsin nonprofit now prompting a bit of a broader look at how state government oversees organizations receiving millions of dollars in taxpayer funding. So this was all part of the legislators' joint audit committee, and they have now approved an audit of Wisconsin's community action agencies. And this all follows the closure of NewCap. This was a nonprofit, served communities up in the northeastern part of the state, and it abruptly shut down and filed for bankruptcy back in March. Now, during this committee hearing, former NewCap executive Carrie Hill telling lawmakers the consequences of that closure extending well beyond the organization.
More than 100 employees suddenly lost their jobs. Small businesses and local contractors were left with substantial unpaid balances, and landlords were left months behind on rental payments.
Hill also testifying that NewCap now reportedly owes about $4 million to roughly 200 different businesses, also individuals. And she raised some concerns, allegations involving spending practices, conflicts of interest, other financial oversight. And the hearing also exposed a bit of a potential gap in the system. Individual state agencies generally only kind of monitor their own programs and the taxpayer dollars they're getting, maybe not the entire entity and kind of the organization as a whole. And we heard from Department of Administration Secretary Kathy Blumenfeld.
It is a challenge to understand the totality of a going concern. And that's really the job of the board, right? Looking at the total governance of the entire operation.
So that's now one of the questions that the Legislative Audit Bureau is going to examine. The committee also approving separate audits for the state's food share program, also the Department of Administration's management of the state building program. So, a committee very active this week, issuing several different audits for some different state agencies.
It's 2:13 here on WTMJ. July 27th, a 99-year-old Milwaukee woman was brutally beaten inside of her South Side home. This happened near 14th and Layton, resulting in severe injuries, including a twice-broken jaw. Emergency responders took nearly 3 hours to arrive after the initial emergency alert. So the forced entry happened about 4:45 in the morning. 23-year-old Joseph Macias pounded on the door, broke his way into the victim's home. And the first 911 call was actually through a third-party medical alert company, something called Life Alert. So it triggered the call to Milwaukee City dispatchers, and it was ultimately misclassified as a low-priority welfare check instead of a battery or break-in. A second call from the medical alert company went out, and it actually patched in live audio from the home in which you could hear the 99-year-old victim screaming for help. The third call came from the 99-year-old victim, who miraculously was able to get to a phone and call 911 at about 8 a.m. saying that she had been attacked, finally prompting a police and EMS response. What happened here? Where was the systematic breakdown and failure? Well, a hearing was held earlier today to walk through the details, and the folks on the local side are admitting to some systematic failures in the operation. You also have some suspensions and firings to go along with this. Nizir Spencer of WTMJ was at that hearing earlier today. Main takeaways here, Nizir, is systematic failure or any sort of accountability being acquiesced to here by the group?
So there is a lot of accountability that they acknowledged during this pressing, but they did not specifically use the words a systematic failure. But Director Tony Bueno acknowledged the department failed to meet its own standards and said leadership needs to look at the broader lessons from what happened.
We obviously didn't meet what we set out to do in our mission, vision, and values, but we committed ourselves to some of our core values, among them accountability and excellence.
Now, he talked a lot about the training, and you know, the news really today was the two call takers were resigned from their positions after the incident, and a dispatcher is still employed with the DEC, the Department of Emergency Communications, but will be trained more in the future to avoid any other situation like this from occurring. And that dispatcher and call taker are different positions, so some standard procedures may be different, but that was not verified to the reporters present today, and no details or list of the policy's changes were given.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part, because this is obviously a disturbing story, and so wanting to maybe hear, and again, kind of differentiating the difference between dispatcher and call taker, they could have maybe done that a little bit more, right? But right, not really stating if what, if any, policies were changing. I mean, not much was really said.
Yeah, really today was just talking about their training and how extensive they put in, the extensive work they put into this training, which is great, but we really want to know, you know, keep transparency with the people about this incident, because it's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that we don't see. And we really wanted to know what happened during this day. And we really tried to press them a little bit with that, but they were unable to take those questions.
So a bit of a lack of transparency is kind of what we're seeing here. You do have a couple of resignations, dispatcher retraining. I also wonder about policy reforms here, Nizir, and if it was brought up. You know, you've got your kind of standard operating procedure in protocols, but I also wonder about, from a supervisory perspective,
right,
where's a supervisor?
Right.
I know it's the wee hours of the morning.
Right.
I get it. It's 4:45 when that first call comes in, or about 5 o'clock in the morning. But from a supervisor standpoint,
right,
how does it even get to this point?
And, you know, that was my main question. I wanted to know if this was an individual, a team incident, a supervisor incident. I wanted to know if what happened. Who is all involved in the situation outside of those three employees? Because I know there has to be some type of supervision. But again, they talked about reviewing training, operational procedures, and standards, which we don't know which standards or procedures that they disobeyed in that instance. But they did not specifically announce an overhaul of supervisory oversight or anything like that, or explain whether supervisors were disciplined or involved in the incident.
And that's concerning, because I think these are questions that people have. I mean, we have them. I think some in the public would as well. I understand this department, they had to do their investigation. The city's obviously involved with this as well. Mm-hmm. And they called this press briefing. They called it, Greg, and they said, okay, we're going to give you what we have in our investigation. And then when the questions wanted to start rolling out, what, they took two of them and then said, okay, that's it.
Yeah, they took two questions and we kind of just kept pressing him about it. And we wanted to know, well, can we get these answers? When can we get these answers? Eventually, one of the DEC employees, they said, well, we can email you what we have and you can answer these questions. But, well, in a timely manner, they said that they could do that, by the way. And I asked a question, okay, what does timely mean? Because we don't really have that many, much information now. How do we know that we're going to be able to get that in the future? And she said she didn't have a timeline. So,
well worth pointing out, Neil, that the City of Milwaukee Department of Emergency Communications completed their internal investigation, and they called for this press conference right. this morning.
Yeah.
And you're saying they answered two questions and then left the room.
And then cut us off as we continue to push for some transparency.
So yes. Could this have been sent in an email?
I think so. I think this could have been,
but that's concerning because I think right. again this is a very disturbing incident, and right. there are more questions that probably need to be answered. But that didn't really happen today.
Now there probably is some stuff behind the scenes with the city that maybe they can't release yet, which I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
And
in
I
that
do
regard.
Believe Director Tony Bueno said on the right. advice of the city attorney's office right. there are certain things because look, this is an investigation. There are mm-hmm. now charges stemming from this that. The city attorney, I think, did come out and say, look, there are certain things that can't be said, which is understandable. But it seemed like the transparency maybe could have been a little more
left.
Forthcoming today.
Yeah, I agree.
In any point of this conference, Nizer, was the victim mentioned?
No victim was mentioned whatsoever. It was mainly about the training and about, you know, just they also talked about this. They're pursuing two outside accreditations that they even though they claim they already exceed the expectations of these two additions. So they really only talked about the training and, you know, what happens in between and the everyday life of these people doing these calls and you know, dispatching. So there was a lot of defending on that part, but no mention of the victim.
So better training is being promised here, a training overhaul, a review of standard operating procedure, yada, yada, yada. It's kind of what it is, right? You had a botched 911 call here and a botched news conference on top of it. That's my assessment of the situation. They screwed it up at the beginning, and they screwed it up when they tried to understand or let people understand what their internal investigation revealed.
Absolutely. And you know, maybe we will get these answers in an email, but I really wish that we were able to kind of get down to business today and answer some of these questions that maybe the public even has as well.
Well, direct your complaints and questions to the City of Milwaukee Department of Emergency Communications. They botched it from the start. It's 2:23. Greg and Neil with you till 3 o'clock. It's a smaller story, Neil, but one I'm sure you've been following here. A record-setting robot at the World Humanoid Robot Games in Beijing. An Olympic-style competition featuring more than 1,300 contests with more than 2,000 robots from 16 countries. I don't know if they had an opening ceremonies or if there will be closing ceremonies. Most of these robots hail from China, for what it's worth. But ABC's Britt Clennant is there. 51 events, including running, long jump, table tennis, ballroom dancing, and all various household tasks, even hotel services and emergency response. That'll be interesting. The Games now in its second year.
It is a really lively, occasionally chaotic, but impressive event, especially when one robot sprinter clocked 100 meters in 9.39 seconds in an opening heat, faster than Usain Bolt's 9.59 world record. So compared to last year, the robots are performing much better, and it is a visible indicator of just how quick this tech is advancing.
You can hear whistles and you can hear people in the wow. background cheering the competition, right? Do the robots really know what's going on here? I did see one robot running in a race. It got to the finish line and it's like robot legs were going in three different directions. And then it bonked and all of a sudden you saw sparks and they had to get the thing off the track expeditiously. But apparently one was able to clock 9.39 in the 100. That's quite the accomplishment.
Now, I mean, is this all to, I mean, they're doing, like you said, everyday tasks. Ballroom dancing stood out to me. Is this just to, you know, companies are, all right, let's get these things ready. And then we'll just start rolling them out. People can bring them into their homes if they need help. Do things around the house. I mean, I think that's where this is probably going.
I am down to have a robot folding laundry thing in my house. I'm down for that. I like that idea of somebody just handling the laundry. Keep the robot in the laundry room. You just do laundry. That's it. That's all it wants you to do. Program it accordingly. Fold it. Bring it back to my room. I'll even put the clothes away. A robot to handle laundry, I can get down
with it. It's worth the investment. Well, I know we have a lot of sports fans tuning in. Greg, you're a sports fan. I love my sports.
You got that right.
Now, if you're a fan that maybe likes to gamble a little bit, place a wager, you might be asking yourself, when is the online sports betting going to be legal? And now this creates a whole other caveat because some might say, well, technically you can. But legally, online sports betting is still not available yet in the state. Now, Governor Evers signed a bill, this was back in April, that basically allowed the tribal casinos within the state to offer online sports betting. And that started a whole process. I think some people thought, okay, the governor signed it, it's good to go. I can log into my phone, I can download the Potawatomi app, and I can start placing bets. That's not the case. It started this other huge process, basically, where the governor has to then meet with all the different tribes and the leaders to then renegotiate. There are these gaming compacts that the state has with the tribes to offer gambling, whether that's at the casino, through sports, so on and so forth. So that needs to be renegotiated, and those talks are happening. The governor has met with the tribes, and then that has to be sent off to the federal government. It needs approval there, and this is all because they're using this hub-and-spoke model, again, allowing the tribes to basically control the online sports betting here in the state, and there's only one other state that's done that. That's Florida. Many of these other states are neighbors. They allow DraftKings, these commercial operators, but that's not what Wisconsin is doing. So that's kind of where things stand with online sports betting through the casinos. I mean, this has been a bit of a process. It's still not available yet. And then that now leads us to, though, some other issues. There are now some legal challenges to the online sports betting that was passed here in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, they filed suit saying, look, being able to offer online sports betting, it goes against the state constitution. So they have filed a suit. They're asking a judge to stop any implementation of online sports betting. So this, you know, hub and spoke tribal model hasn't even been launched, and it's already facing a legal challenge, which I think some thought certainly was going to be the case. So that's kind of the traditional, and again, online sports betting that can be offered through the tribes. That's where that stands. But then there's the confusing part of these prediction markets, which there are a whole nother suit of legal challenges around that.
So it is like three separate things almost. And I'm not sure exactly why these are three separate things, but they are three separate things. And there are loopholes to making these three separate things. So you've got Potawatomi, right? At long last, they can open up a sports book. As of a couple of years ago, everything was put in place. You can go to Potawatomi. You can use their self-serve kiosks. You can go to the window. You can make your bet in the sports book, just like you would if you were in Las Vegas.
Correct.
But you can't do it online. You can't do it through an app on your phone. And that is exactly what the folks at Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk Nation, and so on are fighting for. Because meanwhile, while you can't go to the Potawatomi app and make those bets, you got to go to the physical location and do it. You do have something called Underdog Fantasy, which is a daily fantasy site. And if I look at it today, I could bet on the over-under of number of hits for the Brewers in their game against the Mets. I could put as much money as I want on it, and I could be paid if I win. I can do that on my phone. And then there's Kelce, which is part of this prediction market that you were referencing, which is a whole nether ball of wax. But it doesn't feel like any of this should be legal if Potawatomi's online sports betting is not legal. So that is the big question I think so many have. Well, why can I do Underdog Fantasy and why can I do Kelce and not have a Potawatomi app where I could make a sports bet?
Well, and going to the daily fantasy, the underdog, the prize picks, yeah, that's another interesting one. And kind of how, I guess you could say they're getting away with it, those operators, they distinguish, look, we offer daily fantasy contests. You know, this is, there's no skill involved as opposed to traditional sports betting, you know,
so because there are a game of skill versus game of chance.
Correct.
Right?
And that's how they get away with it. And that's why apps like that have been offered here in the state. Now you go to the prediction markets, which are somewhat similar. Now, how they're kind of getting away with it across the nation is they determine, look, we offer these event contracts. Basically, you're saying yes or no, this is going to happen. But now it's delved into sports they've offered. They're offering bets on politics. Everyday events, you can bet if it's going to rain on some of these sites like Kelce. And they get away with it again because it's managed federally. The Federal Trading Commission and the Futures Trading Commission, they are saying, look, Congress gave us the approval to oversee these companies that offer these prediction markets. And because it's being allowed through Congress, it can be offered nationwide. Now, Wisconsin, they do not agree with that. And here's Attorney General Josh Call.
You can, on those prediction markets, purchase what they call an event contract. And what we allege here is that the event contracts on sporting events are indistinguishable legally or practically, for that matter, from sports betting and constitute sports betting under Wisconsin law.
So this was, I think, over a month ago now. Josh Collin, the DOJ here in the state, they are suing Kalshi, Polymarket, all these other prediction markets saying, look, you're basically offering online sports betting and that's not legal right now. Sure, we did legalize it, but it's only through the tribes. We want our tribal casinos to be able to offer this, not these other sites. So there's all these now lawsuits. One of these companies, Novig, which I had not really heard of, I guess they're kind of a prediction market involved with some of these others. They're now trying to sue the state saying, look, you can't block us from offering these different markets. So it's creating a kind of a bit of a headache. And all of this, again, as the state is trying to get what they approved, what the governor signed, this legal online sports betting through the tribes, that process is still going on. And now you've got all these other things kind of weighing in as well. So it's complicated, to say the least.
Well, Kalshi, Underdog, Prize Picks, DraftKings, you name it, right? They are a product that is, I guess, non-traditional in terms of being a sports book, right? In other words, they don't have to wait for a tribal sports book infrastructure to roll out to be up and running in the state of Wisconsin, because Wisconsin's sports betting landscape is strictly regulated and tied to these tribal gaming compacts that you talked about, and Governor Evers signed an assembly bill, 601, to legalize statewide mobile sports books. However, they're not yet live because the individual tribal compacts and tech infrastructure need to be approved first. So I also do wonder, you mentioned what Call is doing, but we'll have a new governor here in the state of Wisconsin in November, and it's not likely that this will all be resolved before then. So either Tom Tiffany or David Crawley is either going to have to, you know, pick it up and take it forward, or re-examine and try and figure out what direction to go here. But I know this is something that really aggravates the tribal gaming folks, because they've got it. They've got the technology. All they need to do is get the green light and they'll move forward with what they think they should have to run up against competition with these others.
And it is interesting, because those, I've talked to those who cover kind of the sports betting scene nationally, and they're like, look, I think they'll get this rolling. Governor Evers, he's the one who signed it. Would he want to get it done on his watch before he's out of office? But at the pace it's going. And then the other caveat, again, with these prediction markets, which are federally regulated, but again, the state doesn't see it that way because they're offering basically sports betting on their apps. For Wisconsin to get online sports betting through the tribes, it does have to get approved federally.
Yeah.
And now you've got the state basically suing these companies and, to a degree, suing the federal government because they're allowing these to be offered. Does that throw a wrench in getting the online sports betting approved? I don't know. There's a lot going on.
So are we kind of in a holding pattern right now, or is there something on the calendar that kind of advances this or at least moves it one direction or the other?
From what we know currently, the Governor Evers and the tribal leaders are still in the process of getting the gaming compact kind of renegotiated. They all have to come to an agreement on that before it goes to the federal government. From what I've been told, there have been meetings, but really no definitive answer when that timeline could come and when it gets sent off. So I don't know. And now we're in the midst of a, you know, gubernatorial race. This might hit kind of the back burner here.
It's 2:48 here on WTMJ. Not to turn this into a sports talk show of any kind, but the SEC is hopping into the same category and bet as the Big Ten, which recently announced that you're not coming back. As soon as you make that pledge to be a professional and you sign a contract with an NFL team or an NBA team or a WNBA team, that is it. Even if you've got that extra year of eligibility, you cannot come back to play for one of our member schools. Now, this came to light recently because there are a couple of guys who got out of the college football ranks, tried to make their way into the NFL, one with the Browns, one with another team. Well, they were recently cut. And they decided, you know what? Didn't work out at the NFL level. I'll just go back to college. And they were recruited to play at LSU in the SEC, a perennial college football power. So that got the Big Ten to saying, look, that ain't happening with us. We are not going to do this. Well, the SEC is hopping into the same boat here. SEC schools that bring back NFL, NBA, or WNBA players to their programs will face steep discipline under a new policy unanimously approved by the conference's 16 members. This confirmed to ESPN. There was a meeting earlier today, and momentum now to just put this all to rest. And at the heart of the conversation is LSU head football coach Lane Kiffin. Always a bit controversial throughout his time as a head coach, not only in the NFL, but at the college level. Lane Kiffin has said, look, I don't think they should come back and play at the college level, but there's a court order that suggests they can. So it's either I recruit them or somebody else does.
Over 100 athletes in multiple sports were cleared and said, you can go play whether you signed pro contracts or not, whether you participated in training camps or mini camps, you are allowed to play. And that is the court order. So all court orders have been followed. So I think you're going to get in a really interesting situation if now, as a conference, you start to say, well, we're not going to follow this court order that's been issued. And we're going to say that these kids that the court says can go anywhere, we're going to say, no, you can't.
So court order is now being challenged by the member institutions, and in this case, the conferences, so the Big Ten and the SEC. So here's what it says in the SEC agreement. Previously declared for the NFL, NBA, or WNBA draft and did not appropriately withdraw. In other words, you've got these kind of feeling out times where I'm going to test to see where my draft stock is, and if I don't like it, well, I'll pull my name out of the draft and I'll just go back to college. That happens every year, and there is a deadline for making that decision. If you extend beyond the deadline, the SEC and Big Ten are saying, that's it, you've exhausted your eligibility. Number two, you sign a contract with an NFL or other professional football league, NBA, G League, or WNBA affiliate team. You sign the contract, you get paid money, whatever amount of money that is, you cannot come back. Number three, been listed on an NFL, NBA, G League, or WNBA affiliate roster. If you're listed on the roster, you show up in the depth chart, that's it, regardless if you've played a game in the preseason, regular season, or not. So they're trying to get ahead of this, but it was really Lane Kiffin's action that sort of prompted this review by the Big Ten and SEC, and I would think other conferences will follow suit. But I understand Lane Kiffin's point, not that I often agree with the man, but he says, if I don't recruit these players, others will. This is an arms race, right? These kids are now getting paid, and in some cases, more money at the college ranks than they will ever make in the professional ranks.
I think all of it's just a little too late. I mean, these players, and look, agents involved now with this NIL money, they were able to find a way, right, go to the court, be able to get this, you know, eligibility back, and now the conferences are like, okay, wait a minute, this doesn't maybe seem like the right move. And now they're coming out, so I respect them trying to do it, but no, I mean, it's going to be hard to go against, I guess, what some of these courts, and this is happening across the country, of all these, you know, circuit courts and these judges making these decisions. It's putting college athletics in an interesting spot, well, if it isn't already.
No doubt about that. And again, you're talking about you know, guardrails trying to be put in place. Well, this goes back to the NCAA and their just complete mismanagement of their archaic rule book. It just not choosing to evolve, instead putting it in the hands of the courts to decide what amateurism is. And if student athletes are employees of the university, therefore they should receive a paycheck. Or if they're student athletes and they're on scholarship and no, their name, image, and likeness should not be rewarded financially. Well, the NCAA screwed that up from the start. The guy in question here, one of the guys, his name is Daquan Wright. He played tight end for Ole Miss. That is an SEC school. He dressed for the Cleveland Browns preseason game on Saturday. He did not play. He was waived on Monday. He was unclaimed on Tuesday. And LSU said, we'll take you. Right? So, I mean, that was what prompted all of this, and now it appears he will not be able to play at the college ranks. It is a crazy Wild West sort of world right now, and you just can't keep up with all of the things that are popping up at the NCAA level that nothing is amateurism anymore at the NCAA level. It is not. You can get paid to play whatever sport you're playing.
Now, the funny thing is that, you know, this is going on right now, LSU football. They just hired a new coach, Will Wade, who some people might know in the college basketball ranks. Similar thing. He's trying to, over the summer, has been trying to get some athletes that have already turned pro and say, oh, come on back. So
I never thought I'd say this, but I liked it so much when the players were getting paid illegally. It just seemed a lot more fun, right? It just, you know, everybody was doing it, some a little more than others, and many out of the SEC were doing it, I tell you that much, and now they're the ones balking at the entire idea of a player coming back to be paid. Interesting. 2:57 here on WTMJ. We are out of time. Wisconsin's afternoon news is right around the corner. And then we've got Brewers baseball coming up at 5:35 tonight. It is game two, Brewers and Mets from New York.